Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's unfair to dictate to anyone how they should grieve or judge the bereaved for finding comfort in more unconventional methods of mourning or ways of continuing bonds with the deceased.
So today we have a really interesting episode of the podcast, and it's something a little bit different. We're delighted to be joined by Kelsey Donnelly, who is a PhD graduate from Queen's University in Belfast. And Kelsey got in touch with us about her research that looks into the ways in which 21st century literature can provide a new perspective on our grief, as well as the political emphasis to resolve, process, or recover from grief as rapidly as possible. I have to say, Kelsey, when I got your message, I was immediately really interested in your work.
Thank you.
And I chatted
to our
producer Ian right away and sort of said, I think this sounds really relevant and really interesting, especially right now. I think we just get right into it. I mean, we are living, you know, I know your work covers this, and I've read some of the stuff you've written about it. But when it comes to grief, we're living in an unusual time. I don't know if that's the right word, but we're definitely living in a time when grief is prevalent across everything we're doing in our world, in our lives. Can you start just to talk a little bit about kind of the relationship of, you described COVID as sort of a state of suspension, which I feel like is so, like, probably one of the best things I've read about it. It does feel like a state of suspension that we've been in. Can you just chat to us a little bit about the research you've done in looking at COVID and grief?
Yeah. Well, the COVID angle that I wrote an article quite recently about, it was during my PhD, and it was quite different for me because my research is focused more on, well, it's 9/11 literature and 21st century American literature more broadly. But at the time, whenever I was writing about it, a lot of the issues seemed to speak to the pages beyond my thesis. And COVID at the time was being compared by some American media outlets to 9/11, which I thought was quite an interesting connection and quite unusual and quite unexpected. But it really started to make me rethink ideas about grief in the context of COVID. And I write in my research about still life and how grief is this time of suspension and deep reflection on feeling, on memories, and this really profound experience. And it's distinct from this fast pace of progress that constitutes everyday life. It's so busy. But grief sort of stills life in that sense, and we're in this sort of liminal space between past and present. And I found myself feeling like that during COVID. For me, even at the minute, when people talk about the seasons, it still feels like we're in March at the beginning of lockdown. But I thought, yes, the idea that we're living some sort of still life at the minute because everyday life has in some ways ground to a halt. And I thought that really coincided with the suspended time of grief. But also, you know, this sort of suspension, I think, in a way has given us time to really reflect on things that we wouldn't necessarily have had time to reflect on before. But as well as that, obviously, grief practices have changed quite drastically with regards to grieving our loved ones during this time of COVID because of the restrictions surrounding funerals and public commemoration services. So grief really has taken on, and how we express grief and how we publicly mourn our loved ones has, I think, really changed during this time. I mean, and it's really, really difficult.
It is very, very difficult. And I think in the last few months, I've we've started to really see the impact of very few people being allowed to attend funerals, not being mm-hmm. able to hug, not being able to take someone for a coffee, not being able to do the things that we're as humans we do.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I thought was kind of interesting that you said, and this is ties into the sort of like more global look at things, just progressive and profound change, how grief can kind of like really do that and how it can play that part. Joe Biden is a very interesting person right mm-hmm. now in many ways, but from a grief from a grief perspective, he's also, I mean, to have this election and being one of the biggest things to happen, and actually in terms of the state of suspension, for something to actually sort of move in a different direction mm-hmm. within that state of suspension, but also to have someone at the forefront who is someone who's no stranger to grief and who speaks quite openly about loss and empathy mm-hmm. and his family, do you think that that will have an impact in sort of how the world looks at grief potentially?
I think it will. I mean, I hope it does, because I think that he has channeled a lot of his experiences of grief in some ways into his approach to life and his interactions with other people. And he, for me anyway, I think he comes across as quite an empathetic person.
Mm.
And a lot of, I was watching a documentary on him a few weeks ago, and he talked about the death of his son, and he said he felt a compulsion, you know, to run for the presidency. He was in some ways motivated a lot by his family and this compulsion to make things better, especially after the Trump presidency.
Yeah.
But I think as well, even, you know, so I think he does retain this idea of grief, but also hope as well,
mm.
you know, and I think that's what the world needs right now, because even after the 2016 election, another sort of interest that came up in my research was this feeling of profound grief
mm.
for a future that may never have unfolded. People sort of had expectations, you know, of things, how they would change if, you know, Hillary Clinton or you know, these expectations. And then there was a sudden sort of mourning for a lost future
mm.
that they had imagined. So I really hope that the Biden presidency will be able to draw on his experiences of grief to facilitate this profound change that I think grief can honestly engender.
This is a tough question. I don't know the answer even in the slightest. So I mean, you've done a lot more work on the research side of this, so maybe you have an insight into it. I mean, when you look at, so when it comes to grief, obviously there's a lot of information and some of it outdated at this point, but in terms of like the stages of grief or mm-hmm. moving from one state of grief to the next or evolving mm-hmm. or all those kinds, and a lot of it has been kind of evolved over the years, and people no longer feel as though you go through stages, but that you more kind of learn to live with it. When as mm-hmm. when like a society or the, you know, globally, we go through a collective grief,
mm-hmm.
you know, is there stages of moving beyond it? Is it something that we kind of embeds into us and is then part of us as we go forward, and how we informs how we create our new society, which obviously we will after this? What are your feelings on that?
I think when I started my PhD and I was reading so much of the academic grief scholarship that had been conducted, and primarily within the psy disciplines and the social sciences, when I was reading it, I realized that some of the really prevalent ideas, and they're still so influential, like the stage models, they're so skewed in ways, they're almost very mechanical, and they adopt this quite reductive approach, I would say, with regards to the nature of human interdependency. And so when I was looking at some of the literary texts that I was examining for my thesis, they really challenged two of the main underpinning assumptions of the most dominant model of grief that is pretty prevalent in a lot of bereavement counselling as well. So they challenged this idea that grief is primarily a psychological response to loss that is amenable to diagnosis and diagnostic criteria. And they also challenged this, I think, really very problematic idea that grief is diagnosable as pathological
mm.
if the bereaved have not returned to this pre-bereavement state as rapidly as possible. And the idea that grief that persists after 6 to 12 months is in some ways pathological. That idea, I think, is so difficult to comprehend and so far removed from the actual reality and very embodied lived experience of grief. So there's sort of this stigma attached. And although I think we have moved on, and I think the actually like popular discourse has been more, I think it's developed a lot quicker than the academic grief scholarship that has conducted, that still very much works within those ideas of prescriptive phases and timelines and moving beyond grief to reach the state of a recovery. But I think even, you know, talking about grief recovery, it implies that grief is some sort of obstacle to overcome, when actually it's an all-encompassing experience that I don't think can ever be overcome as such. You know, it stays with us, it changes who we are. And this idea of returning to this pre-bereavement state, I think, is just, it's almost illusory.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah, I think anyone that's been through, you know, would agree with you that anyone who's been through a loss, it's this it's transformative, completely transformative, whether or not you know that as it's happening, or you look at it retrospectively and you recognize that you are a different person due to the loss of someone you love. Do you think people are, you know, when people are speaking, quite like, is it naive to believe that there's a you know, in terms of maybe like in your work with 9/11 and how the world never went back to what it was pre 9/11, and how the world will not go back to how it was pre COVID. Do you think people are being naive when they hang on to the hope of returning to normal?
It's always hard to know, isn't it? This time hindsight is a great thing. But sometimes I hear people just, you know, in everyday conversations saying, you know, things will return to normal. Now there's a vaccine, we will go back to life as it was. And I think, you know, I think it is a bit naive, because the idea of returning to ordinary life when such fundamental change has taken place, I think, I mean, not in the foreseeable, not within 3 months at least. I don't think that's going to happen. But I think this experience of COVID, it really has, it's changed a lot of things that I didn't necessarily think were possible. For instance, locking down airports, you know, like locking down businesses, it almost feels surreal. And if someone had asked me this time last year that we would, or someone had told me that we would be experiencing this and we'd be walking around with masks and we wouldn't be able to see our loved ones except through a window pane, or grandparents would be separated from their children, I would never have thought that possible.
No.
And I think so much of this will stick with us. And what I sort of took a lot from my research was that grief, it makes us appreciate like the ordinariness of life, in a sense. You know, we take for granted many things. And I think when we experience grief, we start to actually appreciate those little small things. And I think in living in this sort of COVID era, I think I myself have taken a renewed or gained a new awareness of the importance of everyday life and the things that we used to take for granted, just simple things like shaking hands, like giving someone a hug, as you said. Now it's just to be able to do that with someone that we haven't seen in so long, it's, you know, it would it's just, it means so much more. It's so much more profound, I think.
Almost feels risque or something. It's like a neighbor hugged me. I had a baby 6 months ago. And when I was just about to have the baby, I was pretty heavily pregnant. A neighbor of mine, she just said, she just looked at me and said, "I can't help it." And she just gave me a big hug. And I felt like we'd done something terribly wrong. But it also, it felt like the most wonderful 2 seconds that I'd had in so long, because first of all, because of the spontaneity of it, the fact that she just went with her instincts, and we really can't, spontaneity is completely diminished from our lives because we have to think so cautiously about everything we're doing. I wanted to just talk to you a little bit about minority groups, because that's part of your research, and certainly with what has happened in America, and I as an American, obviously, this is leaning a little American, guys. I'm sorry for this episode is a little American heavy, but I'm very interested in kind of how in the last year, obviously, things have been really difficult in America in terms of race relations and everything else. But in terms of how minority groups and grief, can you talk a little bit about what your research found in that area? Because I think it's something that's really important to talk about.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite texts that I read during my research and wrote on is by an American poet called Claudia Rankine. And she wrote Citizen, an American Lyric, and it's quite a prolific text, and you probably have heard of it. But I wrote about the lyric that preceded it. It's called Don't Let Me Be Lonely, an American Lyric, and it talks very much about the relationship between poetry and how we might commemorate Black lives and how we might make them matter through poetry. And Rankine defines the condition of black life in America as one of mourning. And in both of her American lyrics, she demonstrates how everyday life for millions of black Americans is actually defined by death. So grief, it becomes this all-encompassing chronic experience rather than something that can be worked through or something that has a beginning and an end point. And I have a wee bit of the book beside me. If I could talk about one episode where she...
Yeah, please do.
She talks about grieving for a man called James Byrd Jr., who was murdered in June 1998. And she recalls the memory of his death, and in doing so, she makes it very public. But just to give you a bit of background, she actually describes his death in very visceral terms, writing, "On June 7th, 1998, three men, John King, Lawrence Brewer, and Sean Berry, offered James Byrd Jr. a ride home in Berry's pickup truck. Byrd was walking along a road in Jasper, a rural town in East Texas. He was returning home from his niece's bridal shower. Instead of bringing him home, the men brought him to a clearing in the woods where they beat him and chained him to the back of a truck. They then sped along a road just east of the town. Byrd's shredded torso was found first, then his head, neck and right arm were found about a mile away. Police said a trail of blood and body parts stretched for 2 miles. That representation for me, it's so visceral, and it's, it's just so graphic. And it's interesting because this memory resurfaces while the lyricist, the American lyricist of the title, is watching television coverage of the results of the 2004 US presidential election. And while she's watching it, she also recalls that Bush couldn't remember the details of Byrd's death, even though it happened in Bush's home state of Texas. So the lyricist and Rankine overall, she intimates that the re-election of the president is an indication that for many of Bush's supporters, they're willing to assimilate or realize that ordinary anti-black racism is not something past but present, ongoing, and it's okay. It's okay for Bush to forget about it. It's his supporters, she sort of suggests that his re-election implies that his supporters live with this, they assimilate it into everyday life and still consider this life to be good and vote for it to continue. And she talks to the TV as if she were talking to Bush. She says, "You don't remember because you don't care." And then the reader is then forced into a face-to-face encounter with Byrd, because the poet Rankine, she prints an image of Byrd's face on the page. So in this way, the responsibility for remembering his death and his suffering is shifted from Bush to the reader. And the lyricist, she responds by saying, you know, with sadness, and says, "This sadness lives in the recognition that a life cannot matter. Or as there are billions of lives that do not matter, my sadness is alive alongside this realization." And even though this text was written in 2004, and the Black Lives Matter movement was created in 2014, it's very, very prescient. And even I found in ways, because it reminded me so much, because she's counting the votes coming in during the election. Yeah. And again, it very much spoke to the present, and she's like, "I'm losing hope." But like, this time it was quite different. But in a way, it speaks to this year's presidential election, because although the outcome was obviously different, there's this idea that even after the protests of George Floyd's death, and you know, it brought so much publicity to the reality and prevalence of police brutality in the US, and you know, we saw so much public expression of grief, and you know, at the time a lot of people said, "This will change everything, this man's death is not in vain." And it had such, you know, a massive impact. But it is also quite striking that such a large percentage of the population still voted for Trump, even though, you know, his response to the protest was, you know, arguably, you know, it was lacking, or, you know, offensive, or just unsympathetic.
I mean,
in
I think
ways.
It comes back to like that maybe the word condone, like it's saying, you know, this happened while I, you know, you see, they like. Every president has a choice. I recognize that it's not a simple choice, because I know that there's probably an awful lot of bureaucracy and things that go involved with these decisions. But he had a choice how to approach it, and how to recognize it, and how to honor a man's life who represented so much to so many. And the choice was to condone it, and therefore, by condoning it, I you know, every vote.
Yeah.
I mean, I that's, you know, my politics probably aren't a secret to anyone, but to me, that saying that I'm okay with that is something that I could never in a million years imagine doing. And if you could honor someone in some way, then the vote against that person would be the one way that you could try and work towards change. We're gonna start to wrap up now, but I just had one last question for you, because I just wanted to know what your feeling on it was. It was actually when Ian and I first talked about doing this interview, it was one of the first things that it had just happened. So this happened a couple of weeks ago, but the Kanye West hologram, I know we're going into kind of pop culture here a little bit, but the Kanye West hologram that he gave Kim Kardashian for her 40th birthday, if anyone hasn't seen it, I don't know how you haven't seen it yet, but if you haven't seen it, it's a hologram of her dead father speaking to her from the current day. It's hard not to think of it as a big moment in grief. I think it is, because obviously I know in Black Mirror, the TV show, they had done an episode on it, and a lot of people who had experienced grief spoke about it and how they would feel. And it's always people who have lost someone. How would I feel if I were given the chance to speak to someone who I loved, who I lost again, but it's not really them? What are your feelings on that as a cultural kind of, as a moment or as an idea or as a...
I thought it was really, really fascinating, I have to say. And to me, it was a very, because I have completed my PhD, it actually really opened new pathways for me for thinking about grief in terms of digital death and grief culture, whether it's online. Personally, like, I had a very visceral response to it. I found it quite unsettling and uncanny. But it was, I think Kim's response was quite interesting too, because she was very pleased with it, obviously. I think she said it was the gift of a lifetime, a special surprise from heaven. And I think when I look at the comments that it received, I think about, you know, the mixed reception. I think it's always important to preface any discussion when we're talking about grief responses, about, you know, it's unfair to dictate to anyone how they should grieve or judge the bereaved for finding comfort in more unconventional methods of mourning or ways of continuing bonds with the deceased, to create a sense of an ongoing relationship with them after they've died. because, you know, if anything, grief is so unpredictable. And although we may not understand why she maybe enjoyed the hologram, it's not our place to, you know, necessarily say that it's unwelcome or it's, you know, it's bad or it's, you know. But actually, yeah, like I think the whole issue, it raises so many important issues with regards to consent and the rights of the dead, who gets to speak for the dead. And is there a case that the holograms, is it in some ways a puppet? And its digital creators or its script writers are master manipulators? It's there's so many ethical concerns. That's what I find very much about it. And we don't know whether I can't confirm because I'm not friends with the Kardashians, whether Kanye West was the person who wrote the script, but because there's that line.
I think maybe it was. I'm just guessing.
I think we can hazard a guess.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not 100% sure, but yeah.
He was. Yeah. I know. The most. I feel like I lost count of the amounts of most that he used.
It does.
But yeah.
Yeah, it raises so many. I mean, even from like, you know, financially, how, you know, certain people will be able to access things like this. Or is it done algorithmically where you have conversations based off, you know, online conversations? It's really like... truly,
yeah, it's and it really, you know, and it does make you think, because I think a lot of people think, oh, those crazy Kardashians, what will they get up to next?
Yeah,
but it's actually, it could be a really like real possibility.
Watershed, because
it's true. And I think so much of the content as well, like it was quite staged, and we have this like idea that they're sharing very intimate memories, but actually it sends a very, very public message under the illusion of sending a very private one. And I think it got me thinking, because of Kim's influence, will gifting someone a hologram become the next big trend in digital death culture? Might one day we be signing release forms giving permission to our descendants to create a posthumous hologram of us? And even if so, to whom do we give permission, and how can we guarantee what images or words they might put into our mouths? And if anyone then can create these, you know, there is the very real possibility that people could misuse our digital data for more sinister purposes in ways that are degrading or vengeful, harmful for both the dead and the bereaved. So there's so many, even with regards to ownership, and I think digital tech companies sort of seizing this opportunity off the publicity that the hologram garnered to attract or to boost their business. Because I think presently the Rob Kardashian hologram, I was having a look because I was like, how do they make these things? But his hologram is currently the face of the company that created it.
Oh, wow.
And so it's therefore being used as promo material or as advertising without his consent. So again, you know, it's almost like that sort of trying to capitalize on this and to commodify the dead and their memories, but in a sense to profit from grief and those who are desperate to reunite with the dead in any shape or form. So there's so many issues, and almost like I think there needs to be some sort of regulatory framework that needs to be introduced to protect the rights of the dead and the bereaved in this sense. Because once it's shared, and Kim's obviously, she was shared by millions of her followers on social media, anyone with a phone could technically download it and then maybe misappropriate it further for sinister ends. I think that's actually, oddly enough, when I was thinking about the commodification of it, companies could also, you know, pitch the idea that purchasing a hologram for the bereaved is a way of giving someone the gift of goodbye, especially now in the COVID context, because there are so many restrictions surrounding funerals, and, you know, we mightn't get to say goodbye to our loved one because we can't physically be with them, we can't hold their hand. So it could be misused in this way.
Well, you've given us so much to think about, Kelsey. Thank you so much for joining us. It was really great to have your insight and talk about your work on the podcast. Thanks again, and hopefully we'll chat to you again.
Thank you so much. It's a real privilege.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.